This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Do you plan to retire in Greater Boston one day? A lot of attractive reasons to consider that, from our healthcare system to our restaurant scene, state parks, cultural institutions. But then there's the cost. New data from UMass Boston's Center for Social and Demographics Research on Aging suggests that Massachusetts is the most expensive state to age in the country, especially if you're living alone, as thousands of older residents here do. With more than 20% of the state's population 62 or older, according to the census in 2021, we have some grappling to do because aging affordably is a key piece of well-being. Two guests join us now for this latest edition of Be Well. Caitlin Coyle is director of the Center for Social and Demographic Research on Aging. That's at the Gerontology Institute at UMass Boston. And Sandra Harris is state president of AARP Massachusetts. Caitlin, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Sandra, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much for having us.
So, Caitlin, I'm going to start with you. You found it costs nearly $10,000 more a year here in the Commonwealth than the nationwide average for older residents to cover their basic expenses. So why? Why is it so relatively hard here?
Really, that's a story of cost of living. Things here in New England, and more specifically here in Massachusetts, are just more expensive. And of the things that are included in that elder index, sort of the cost of living, one of the biggest drivers of cost is housing. So people spending a significant portion of their income on housing. And you can imagine once you retire and that income becomes fixed, that that creates an even bigger problem.
So Sandra, I'm sure you're talking to members all the time. Illustrate this for us with a member that you know who lives in this space where it's risky, it's hard, because it's hard to cover those costs of living.
Oh, we hear from our members all the time, especially on the high cost or rising cost of housing. You know, you think in terms of someone who has retired and lived in especially the Boston area all these years, and now are on limited income. And with the cost of housing, there's no middle housing. So, for example, my example is I live in the South End of Boston, and we purchased our condo in 1997. And, you know, it's a typical condo with, housing lot that's specific almost to Boston. But if we were to develop immobility issues, and even with appreciation cost, and I want to stay in my community, if I want to stay in the South End, even with appreciated cost, I could not afford to do that.
So what's striking about that, Sandra, is it's not just the immobility issues of age and the body becoming less mobile, but you're saying one becomes locked in at a certain point and are immobile in terms of your ability to move around Greater Boston.
And not only that, take property taxes. That's a huge problem for a number of our members.
So, Caitlin, you are nodding vigorously through this whole thing, so pick it up from there.
I would just add to what Sandra has said. I mean, it's the piece about property taxes in particular is, you know, is a real cost and a real challenge for a lot of residents, particularly in Boston. And I think the other piece that Sandra mentioned is this idea of living in her community. You know, it's so important in addition, you know, to live in a place where you feel comfortable, you feel familiar, you feel confident as you age. And that's a real issue. People who may not be able to continue afford living in Boston, they go elsewhere. And that can create a lot of challenges for folks beyond just the financial pieces.
I bumped my mic there. Sorry. I want to stay there, Caitlin Coyle of UMass Boston, Sandra Harris of AARP Massachusetts, because this is a well-being issue. I mean, this is about the financial piece of aging in place, of being able to retire in a community you love, like Greater Boston. But as Caitlin is saying, the ability to do that is so much more than the money to cover basic costs. There's a lot that goes into well-being with this.
Absolutely. You know, one of the real things that we're looking at is the cost of not being connected, loneliness and social isolation. It's a real cost. And also, you know, taking care of things like prescription medication. That's a very, very serious problem. And we know that some help has been given to especially people on insulin. But, you know, oftentimes we hear members calling in saying that they have to make a choice between paying for their rent or food or buying medication.
And, of course, we know from the research that things like loneliness and social isolation can lead to depression, heart disease. They can have an effect on dementia. So there's a lot of impacts there.
Absolutely.
So, Caitlin, the other thing that was interesting in your research is this idea that there is this gap. Now, I used to do a lot of anti-poverty work and for families, we're aware of this gap between you. Basically, you earn and you earn too much for state programs like SNAP or that's a federal program, but you know what I mean, for benefits. Mm-hmm. And yet you don't really earn enough to cover your costs. And you found that to be an issue for older adults, a fairly wide swath of mm-hmm. older adults in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's really people who are not necessarily falling below the elder index, but are really living sort of in the gap. And I think one of the issues there is that those folks, when they retired or throughout their career, they were considered middle class. They worked, they had good careers, they saved, they had a good setup. But because costs have risen so much and because things have changed so much, that no longer cuts it. And so you see this wide group of people.
So they didn't exit the middle class because they stopped working. They exited the middle class because as they stopped working, the environment around them changed so dramatically. Okay, and just very briefly, you use that phrase elder index. It is the study that you do to measure all of this. Just briefly define what elder index is for our listeners.
Sure. So it's a cost of living metric that's calculated for every county in the United States, taking into account a sort of bare bones budget of things like healthcare, transportation, housing, and food. So really a measure of what does it cost to actually live?
So, Sandra, that hits me too, because there is quality of life beyond the bare bones budget. When people fantasize about retirement, I mean, even those who are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, they're not thinking, I want to retire one day in Greater Boston and find a way to meet my bare bones budget, right? Retirement is supposed to be respite and joy and the next thing.
Well, I think that's changing. We know that people are living longer and they're more actively engaged and healthier. So people are beginning to now look at that stage of life and making decisions of how they want to spend that rest of their life, that part of their lives. So it's very important, I think, that we as Massachusetts, and some of the things that we're promoting at AARP is making sure that there are options. For example, we have encouraging residents to stay in the workplace longer. But we do know that ageism is a problem in the workforce, right? And we are, for example, we have a program at AARP called the Employee Pledge Program, where employees pledge to make sure that they are recruiting and retaining older adults. So there are numbers of issues and things that we're working on. We are trying to promote a bill now where we're asking the state to defer property taxes until the person dies or the home is sold. So I think there's a lot of things that we can come together
So literally the state could say for the next 5 years, you don't pay any property taxes, but the total cumulative value would be taken from the value of the estate after dying.
Yes, I think we do have something like that already active, but we're trying to really improve that because there's so many complaints from older adults.
So, Caitlin, what else are you thinking about in terms of creating a financially more well place for people to retire and spend their older adult years in Massachusetts?
Yeah, well, I think as Sandra mentioned, there are a number of programs in place, particularly around property taxes and some of the support programs like related to nutrition and transportation that are in place. And so one big push, I think, is around getting people to be more aware of those things and to help them sort of understand whether or not they're eligible. I think the other piece that I think about is really getting people to think about this ahead of time and to sort of remove some of the fear that's related to
how.
Right. To really engaging in planning and thinking about what do you want that next part of your life to look like and how will you make that happen and engaging in some forethought around that. And really trying to get used to, moving away from some of the fear that people have about retirement and aging more broadly, really getting them to think about going to the senior center, reaching out, staying connected to a broader community. And I think, there's a real focus on independence among all people, really, Americans in particular. And I think people really wanting, trying to wrestle with that in terms of where does my independence get me into trouble?
And Sandra, in our last 10 seconds, I'm assuming there are resources about this on your website.
Yes, we have resources, AARP.org or AARP.org/MA.
All right. Sandra Harris is state president of AARP Massachusetts, and Caitlin Coyle is the director of the Center for Social and Demographics Research on Aging at the Gerontology Institute at UMass Boston. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Heroes are actually everywhere. But in comics, they're usually some kind of buff guy that can race faster than a speeding something. So what about female heroes? That is our focus in today's edition of Comics Culture. Who are they? How they've changed? And what they teach us about how we as a society are regarding women in a given moment. Our guide, as always, for Comics Culture, Joel Christian Gill, the inaugural chair of the Boston University MFA program in visual narrative. Joel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And you've brought a guest, Hilary Choate, distinguished professor of English and art and design at Northeastern University. Hilary, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
So, Hilary, I'll start with you. What was the first or one of the first female comic characters that you felt connected to?
Well, that's such an interesting question. I have to say, thinking about female comics and characters, I felt a big connection to Marjane Satrapi's character, which is herself, in her book Persepolis, which came out in 2003. So part of what I've been so interested in the world of comics is thinking about comics memoir and thinking about sort of different kinds of heroes than we're used to thinking about in the fantasy and superhero realm, and thinking about women writing about their own lives. And Marjane Satrapi wrote Persepolis to chronicle her experience growing up in Tehran during the Islamic Revolution and the Iran-Iraq War. And that book went on to be adapted to be a film and was a global bestseller.
So, Joel, that really strikes me. You know, we do tend to think of, even females in comics, we tend to think of like DC and Marvel superheroes, so a Wonder Woman or a Black Widow or a Captain Marvel. But I remember the first time you came on air, you brought Wash Day Diaries.
I know, right?
Right. And that was...
That's great work.
There you go. Four women living their lives.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I don't want to, oh, and that's heroic, but it matters to see those stories told too.
Yeah, and I think that it's, you know, a little bit reductive to talk about women in comics as to talk about them as like this emerging thing or something that's happening like all of a sudden, because women have been in comics since the inception, right? You had Tarpe Mills, who created Miss Fury, who was the first woman superhero created by a woman. You've got Jackie Orms, who was a Black woman creating comics in the Golden Age. So we've always had these women who are creating comics. And it's, you know, and I think now we're paying attention to it. It's kind of like Black people in comics too. Like, people have always been there, but now we're paying attention to it. And it's like, oh, there are people who are doing this.
So Hilary Choate, in listening to Joel there, it makes me then want to ask, has it changed what women can put in comics, the stories they can tell about women and the women they can tell stories about?
Absolutely. So, you know, I have to agree with Joel. And, you know, he mentioned trailblazing female cartoonists like Jackie Orms, who is publishing comic strips in the Chicago Defender in the 30s and the 40s. But I think what has really changed, I think, in the 21st century is the field is so diverse and so fascinating, and there's more room now for stories about women's own lives. And that, I think, is a real difference from earlier comics, you know, pioneered by women in the 20th century. You know, so we get works like Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis, we get works like Alison Bechdel's Fun Home, about growing up as a queer child in rural Pennsylvania with a closeted queer father. That work was adapted to be a Broadway musical that won the Best Musical Tony Award in 2015. So we see a real path forward for stories about women's own lives to be very mainstream in a way that they weren't in earlier decades. So I think of someone like the cartoonist Raina Telgemeier, and she's one of the best-selling, you know, not just cartoonists, but best-selling authors, period, working in book publishing out there today. Her book, Guts, which did a lot to shine a light on mental health, which is a memoir about her growing up, had a print run, an initial print run of 1 million copies. So it's very interesting to me and very moving to me that there's such an appetite today for stories about the texture of women's own lives.
So we're speaking with Hilary Choate of Northeastern University and Joel Christian Gill of Boston University about women in comics, women making comics. Joel, you know, One of the joys of learning from you over time, as we've talked about the genre, is beginning to understand the power of this particular art form to tell stories. And you talked once early on about the space between the pictures.
Yeah.
And how we fill that in for ourselves, and that's part of the power of the medium.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, to build on what Hillary said, which is this idea that women, you know, it's almost like Black people making stories that are devoid of white supremacy. It's like it's really difficult. And so now we've got creators who are like, you know what, I'm not going to do that anymore. And I think women cartoonists are doing the exact same thing. They're no longer thinking about their stories in terms of the male gaze. They're talking about it in terms of like, you know, these are for women by women. And some of those stories transcend that, like I said, Wash Day Diaries or Fun Home or Persepolis. So there are lots of these stories. And I think that connection that, you know, disaffected people in America, in our society, feel is used as a way in comics for them to actually like expand on their ideas and their expression. And I think comics is the perfect mode of that because, you know, it's been looked down as like the lesser than art form. And so when the lesser than art form is considered, whether it's movies, whether it's novel writing or anything, right, when there's this lesser known form that people who are disaffected move into that space and then they make it their own and then people go, oh, wait a minute.
That's good stuff. So Hillary Chute, I'll come back to you. We happened to have an author on yesterday, a YA author named Rebecca Caprera, who has just written a book in verse retelling the story of Arachne, a Greek myth, and completely reframing Arachne as a powerful young woman who has the temerity to tell the truth to the gods, right? And I am curious about the balance now with women in comics, both appearing as characters and creating comics. What is the balance between retelling stories that wore us in old ways versus telling new stories that introduce new thoughts, new possibilities, new ideas? Does both happen? Should both happen? Should old stories be left behind? How do you think about that?
That's such an interesting question because to me, that question, thinking about traditions of storytelling and modes of storytelling, gets at something that I think we see in contemporary comics by women in such a powerful way, which is different approaches to the idea of what's important to articulate in stories about girlhood and womanhood. Mm. So I think for some, the heroic mode is the most significant way to express certain kinds of narratives of development, you know, especially for girls overcoming barriers, for example. I think for others, what has been so interesting, and I think we see this a little bit with the Wash Day Diaries and the sort of earlier version of the Wash Day Diaries, which was a mini comic just called Wash Day, is more just a sense of capturing the texture of everyday life. So I think you do have a heroic mode and one that taps into older stories and new versions of older stories. And then I think you have this really interesting thing happening in comics that has to do with the intimacy of drawing and the ability of the comics frame to provide detail, which is a slice of life, the texture of everyday life, the power of capturing time passing, the power of what it feels like to be a woman in a daily context.
And I think that goes exactly to my idea and the thing that I keep talking about how comics are our empathy machine, right? By telling those stories. And the thing about Wash Day and a lot of these stories, right, is that while they're made specifically for a person, right, for a group of people, they are universal in, like, their themes and their ideas. Like, I ended a Wash Day Diary, like, I want to be friends with these women, right? And
yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, I think that's the thing that sort of transcends. And there are some things that are written specifically for a purpose, right? There are some things that are written for women, by women, about women. And I'm okay because I don't need everything to be centered around me, right? And I can recognize the value in that. But I think that there are those things that we're now starting to see because people are just, like, not making things, you know, like in contrast to the patriarchy, right? Like we're not thinking about the male, women are not thinking about the male gaze, and, you know, creators are not thinking about the oppressor or the mainstream audience when they're doing it. They're just making it. It's kind of like, I always think about it in terms of like, I think things are dope, right? And what I think is dope, hopefully everybody else does. And I think there's some people who don't feel that weight that they have to create these things. And I think in a lot of ways, that's not necessarily heroic in a flippant term. It's
right.
Just like, it's it's just I would say it's just amazing, right? These there are great cartoonists making really great work right now, and I'm really excited to be alive.
So Hilary Choot, you've given some shout outs already. So my last question to you then, in our last 30 seconds or so, what's the story you can't wait to see somebody tell in a comic?
Oh my gosh. that is such a hard question.
Sorry.
Maybe I'll mention a story that has already been told, and I'm hoping for more like it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking of Wash Day Diaries, which we were just talking about, and a book that came out a few years ago that I absolutely loved is by a cartoonist named Ebony Flowers. And the book is called Hot Comb. And it's also in some ways about Black hair care. It's a collection of stories. Some are autobiographical, some are fictional. But going back to Joel's point about the male gaze and work that's reactive to oppressive structures, this is a book that really centers on the Black family and Black girlhood and teenage identity and the sort of relationship of the individual and the collective. So I'm really looking forward to more from Ebony Flowers, and she is a Radcliffe Fellow at Harvard this year, hopefully working on something new that I can read soon.
Oh, man, and you even worked in an extra shout-out. I am impressed. Hilary Choot is Distinguished Professor of English and Art and Design at Northeastern University. Joel Christian Gill is our guide and the inaugural chair of the Boston University MFA Program in Visual Narrative. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How can you not be romantic about baseball?
That is Brad Pitt in the movie Moneyball, and romance is in the air because the Red Sox play their home opener today. It is the first game of the season against the Baltimore Orioles. The Sox are a new-look team this year with a lot to prove, so for more, we sat down earlier this week with Boston Globe sports writer Alex Speer, and I started off by asking Alex how excited he is to return to Fenway Park.
There's a charge of electricity that occurs when you walk into the ballpark for the first time in a new season. And of course, you look forward to it, especially on opening day when everything is in slightly sharper relief in terms of just the contrasts and the contours. Just everything feels a little bit more lively and vital.
So I wonder if there's sort of mixed feelings this year. So for our listeners who may not kind of understand the highs and lows that the Red Sox have been through, so lots of changes over the offseason following a disappointing campaign last season. We missed the playoff last season. And I just want to highlight, so World Series winners in 2018. And then actually since then, sort of a combination of going deep in the playoffs, but also finishing last a couple of times. So how do you carry such highs and lows into a new season?
This is actually a historical rarity. It is incredibly rare that a team experience this kind of contrast of successes and failures over the course of a
period of time. So it's as weird as it seems like it is.
It absolutely is. In over a 20-year period, the Red Sox have 4 championships. Remarkable. Over the last 11 years, they have 5 last place finishes. The most in baseball. Also remarkable in a very different way. And to consolidate those 2 disparate outcomes with that kind of frequency in that short a span of time really hasn't happened much since the 1920s, 1930s in baseball.
So then you have a couple of other sort of pieces of voice and heart of the team. So, star shortstop Xander Bogaerts leaves, goes to free agency. You also have, we don't have the voice of Dennis Eckersley, the former pitcher who was a well-known commentator in the booth. He invented the term walk-off. I always liked when he talked about how much cheese there was on a ball when a pitcher pitched it. He called you Stat Masterson. So really a different feel, Stat, now.
it is different when baseball is, there is so much about baseball's appeal is about familiarity and about the continuities that exist, also the novelties of it. But usually those novelties are layered on slowly, evolving like the seasons, as opposed to abruptly, like a disaster befalling people. And it does change the relationship with the team to have some of these mainstays departing. It changes how people feel about their connection to the team. And so what people then rely upon is something wonderful happening in front of them in order to be able to reconnect with it, right? If Rafael Devers, who was made kind of the face of the franchise after Xander Bogaerts left in free agency, he's going to be with the Red Sox for the next 11 years. And there will be probably a deep connection that forms between a lot of the viewing public and him. And now there's kind of this wait to see who the next person is to take on that in that mold of Ortiz and Pedroia and Pedro Martinez.
David Ortiz, and Dustin Pedroia.
And Xander Bogaerts and Mookie Betts.
Right.
The next forming generation still has to coalesce.
So we will come back later to the Mookie Betts question. We'll do that at the end.
Which remains active 3 years later, right?
No,
pretty
right.
Remarkable.
So let me ask you this. And you wrote a piece in The Globe over the weekend that basically said sort of the modeling that people do to figure out what a team's going to do, that modeling doesn't like this Red Sox team very much. What do you think of this Red Sox team?
You know, I think it's very fair to think that this is a team that maybe looked like it was building to be a kind of mid-80 wins team as a likeliest projection, and then had a kind of devastating setback over the course of the offseason when Trevor Story was injured. He was relied upon to be a star who spent last year making a difficult transition to Boston, and who they were relying upon to be a significant contributor this year.
And I want to stop you there. At shortstop, which is what Xander Bogaerts played, and which is a critical infield role for our listeners who may not know baseball well.
Absolutely. He is kind of at the fulcrum of what the Red Sox want to do, both offensively and defensively. Someone who has power as a hitter, someone who has speed as a runner, someone who has a lot of defensive range, who's able to get to a lot of balls. So they were relying upon him for a lot, and then he required surgery in January that's going to keep him out probably at least for the first half of the season. So that was a significant blow for the team
and the forecasting models. He won't come back at all for this
I would
season.
Say that would, to me, that seems unlikely based on what I've heard from surgeons who have performed this particular kind of surgery
so
that he underwent.
So likely he'll be back at some point.
I think so, and probably a pretty good chance that he's contributing over the last couple of months of the season. At what level, that's to be determined.
Okay, so two sort of statistics questions for you. And you can take them whichever order you want. What's a stat from spring training that gives you hope coming into the season? And what's the thing, sort of that metric you're going to watch most closely in the first games?
There are some very simple stats, I guess, that I would look at for hope, one of which is 98 for Chris Sale, which is the top end velocity that he showed in spring training. He looked like a healthy pitcher.
So
he was throwing hard enough, 98 miles per hour, which is kind of close to his top range of velocity. Chris Sale had been one of the best pitchers of this generation, really one of the best of the 2010 to 2020 period, one of the best pitchers in all of baseball. He threw the final pitch of the World Series in 2018 when the Red Sox won it all, snapping off a devastating slider darting down and away, swing and miss. Red Sox win the championship.
Good looking pitch.
But he's missed most of the last 3 years due to injury.
All right, so I'm going to give you a name. You tell us. Masataka Yoshida.
Fascinating. I think that it's always interesting. It provides a prism through which to examine a lot of things.
Our listeners who Masataka Yoshida is.
Masataka Yoshida is a player who had been a very decorated star in Japanese baseball for a number of years. He is 29 years old and coming over to the United States. The Red Sox signed him to a 5-year, $90 million deal this offseason and paid his former team in Japan an additional $15 million for his services. The Red Sox believe strongly in how he can be an elite hitter in Major League Baseball. He is tiny. I am short. He is also short. I can talk to him eye to eye. He's probably about 5'7", 5'8". But in Japanese baseball, he had been one of the best pure hitters in a number of years. Some evaluators think that he is the best pure hitter coming out of Japan since Ichiro Suzuki, a future Hall of Famer. So he has a chance to be a very important part of their lineup as a hitter, but will also have to endure this kind of jarring cultural transition that teams try to do as much as they can to make that transition as seamless as possible, but it nonetheless remains a transition.
But then we have this, right? Because we also have some skeptics who might have had their minds changed by the World Baseball Classic, and I want listeners to hear this. Japan wins, right, the whole tournament. But with the help of Yoshida's performance, playing for the Japanese national team, Japan was in a 3-run hole against Mexico in the semifinal game. Yoshida takes the plate with runners on first and second. Here we go.
A 2-2 pitch to Yoshida is golfed down the line. It's hooking way up there towards the pole. It's gone! It's tied! An iconic swing!
And that sound from Fox Sports, but we thought we'd also give you the Japanese language version of the call.
Yoshida's打球は、ライト、ライト、ライト、入った! 入った!
That from the Tokyo Broadcasting System. So how are you feeling about his ability to be a heavy performer for the Sox?
Again, I think that if you set aside the question of the transition, I think that he has a chance to be a really special hitter and someone who, in particular, whose hitting style, where he's able to use all fields, particularly as a left-handed hitter, being able to hit the ball to left field. Those hitters tend to have extraordinary success at Fenway Park because left field is very close. Hitters have more reaction time if they're willing to hit the ball in that direction. I think he has a chance to be very, very good, but there are these questions of transition that will exist that may lord over his first season with the Red Sox.
So I promised that I would bring up Mookie Betts, one of the first moves by Chaim Bloom, who's the general manager, 2018. Off goes Mookie Betts, still a legendary battle of a choice, right, among Red Sox Nation. A lot of people saying, boy, if the Sox don't turn it around this year, it's the last year for Chaim Bloom. Do you think so?
I'm not sure that I would say, I wouldn't say that definitively, but I do think that we also need to look at the track record of his two predecessors, Ben Cherington and Dave Dombrowski, both of whom won World Series in their first three seasons in Boston, ended up being fired in their fourth. Chaim Bloom is doing a lot of stuff beneath the surface of the Red Sox, trying to position them for long-term success by elevating their farm system and developing more young talent. And I think that there, objectively, there have been some successes there that are recognized throughout the industry. But it's about wins and losses at the major league level. So if the Red Sox struggle once again, if they're a last place team this year or a disappointment, if the moves that he has made at the major league level don't pan out, then I would certainly think that it's very fair to question whether or not he would be brought back for a fifth season.
All right. Alex Speer, sports writer for the Boston Globe. Your reporting is featured in the new book, The Boston Globe Story of the Red Sox. Have fun at opening day.
Yeah, I hope everyone has fun with it. Enjoy the sense of renewal.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.